Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Joe Howard, and I've got John Gower with me on Zoom. Hey, John.
How you doing?
I am good. All right, John is one of my favorite filmmakers. He flew out from Tennessee to come to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2019, and it's always an honor when someone gets on a plane to come to a neighborhood film festival in Los Angeles. Not everyone does it. And he was also one of the, I'll just be honest, if you ever get the chance to hang out in a bar with John Gower, do it. Absolutely. I feel like we bonded that night. You were one of my favorite people. Of course, I enjoyed everyone I spoke to at that festival mixer. But you stood out. You're just a really charming, interesting guy. So, and then your movie is freaking hilarious. You were there for your movie, Rallentando, which was a short, hilarious comedy that you wrote, directed, and did the music for and everything. And it was a hit at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2019. And I'm also proud to say that it is among the films in the Discover Indie Film TV series. It is in Season 3, Episode 8. So people should watch your film. They should go to Amazon Prime Video any way they can get there. Although a big-ass TV is best. Don't watch it on your phone.
And, correct.
Correct. And just search for Discover Indie Film. Go to Season 3, Episode 8. It's 99 cents an episode, $7.99 for a season. You are watching the, when you watch that series, you're watching films that were handpicked from the festival circuit. So it's really like going to the best film festival you can. And you get to see Rallentando, which is absolutely hilarious. Good shit. So,
thank
John,
you.
I think I warned you. The first question, I know there's a lot more to you than filmmaking, but this podcast is focusing on the filmmaking and you as a filmmaker. So what inspired you to get into the filmmaking side of things?
That's a big question. I guess when I first, it was kind of a confluence of things. I joined a message board back when message boards were a thing, back in the, you know, late 90s.
Yeah, text-only thing.
Yeah. You could do, like, little GIFs. Not GIFs, but the early, like, yeah, text-only for all intents and purposes. And they, it was a Clockwork Orange message board. And I had recently seen Stanley Kubrick's films, except for A Clockwork Orange. My dad got me the Stanley Kubrick collection on DVD, and he removed that DVD from the collection. And
should I ask your age at the time?
At the time, I was probably 15 maybe.
Okay. So he was censoring.
Yeah. And which is odd because I grew up watching, like, Freddy Krueger, Halloween, like, all the slasher films. So this one, though, was, you know, it was outside of the pale as far as he was concerned. And I remember sort of having this, you know, forbidden desire to see this film. The fact that I couldn't watch it made it even more enticing to me. So I joined this Clockwork Orange message board, and they were also a lot of David Lynch fans on this message board. And they didn't, it wasn't like they sat around talking about A Clockwork Orange. That would be weird. But,
right. That was just their starting point for discussing cinema.
Not even cinema necessarily. It was just their starting point for getting together. And then they would just, a lot of them were into lots of weird, dumb stuff like anime, but they were also Lynch fans, and I guess simultaneously I found the DVD, which was not very well hidden, of A Clockwork Orange, and watched that while they were, before they got home one afternoon. And then I saw, I think, Blue Velvet for the first time, David Lynch's film, and I was like, this is it. Like, I want to be a director. I want to write and direct films. At the time, I didn't realize there was a difference between director and cinematographer. So I am more of a Kubrick, David Lynch style director in the sense that the cinematography and the images are the most important thing. The acting is definitely secondary. I don't care what anyone says about those two directors. They pick some of the shittiest actors, and they make them do hundreds of takes to get something that works for their weird feeling they're going for. But yeah, that was it, kind of just, and I started.
Right. So as a teenager, you just got really into really auteur cinema, that where you can tell that the director is the artist here.
Correct.
And at the time, were you also, obviously you were still a budding, you were a musician.
Yeah, I was a musician since I was six. So the music did come first. But I think with film, it was seeing how, you know, there's constraints to music in the sense that there's no visual element and there's often not a narrative element. Whereas in film, you can have a visual element, you can have a narrative element. You don't have to have a narrative element, but I suggest you do. It was kind of like seeing something that was bigger than music and saying, ah, I want to do that.
Right, really a completely different artistic discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, film incorporates music.
Right.
And then actually in interesting ways, music, every once in a while music grabs a piece of film, whether it's a Beatles movie or something else.
Well, yeah, and music can be very cinematic. Like, you know, Wagner, for all of his faults, was ahead of his time. He was writing his music before cinema was even a possibility. And it's no coincidence that early cinema used his music to score their films, because it's very cinematic. It's very John Williams.
It is. It makes you imagine something visual if you're not.
Right.
All right. So teenage John gets completely inspired by a couple of fantastic directors. Do you grab a video camera right away, or?
And Hitchcock.
And Hitchcock.
Yeah, and Hitchcock. No, I, you know, at that time, video cameras were still relatively expensive. I was doing music. That's the, you know, for my work, you know, my parents are working class, middle class. So that, you know, if they're going to invest in piano lessons and eventually bassoon lessons, it's kind of an ask to be like, hey, can you get me an expensive video camera that I can just run around with?
So really, and they were really pricey. Sure. Yeah.
Right. Right. So really, I mean, for the next 10, 15 years, I just watched and appreciated films. I wrote, you know, the beginnings of a few screenplays, never got very far with them. And then it wasn't until five or six years ago when I had enough money of my own that I invested in a DSLR and several lenses and tripods and lights and the whole shebang. And now I have a little, you know, a little production company.
Yeah, you have a little, you're able to produce filmed entertainment or video recordings. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, what we should have mentioned also in the beginning of this is that you actually do have your own podcast. And I'll tell you, I listened to the one where you interviewed one of your, I don't know what level of university, but one of your university music professors.
Right. Yeah.
So I know. So the whole time you were writing scripts and stuff, you were actually studying music at a very high level.
Correct.
Correct. But you were still writing screenplays and stuff. You basically had the love for both arts.
Yes. I mean, for the most part, I was just appreciating film. I was not producing it. I was not writing. Well, in college, I was not writing screenplays. I was reading screenplays. I would read screenplays of films that I'd liked, because it's really fun to go back and read the screenplay and see what all ended up on the cutting room floor.
For sure.
And like, what, you know, what dialogue changed in the moment or all this, you know, that's always fascinated me.
Yeah. And there was a really cool era. I remember the film I associated with most was Sex, Lies, and Videotape. But there was an era where when there was a hit indie film, someone would just publish the screenplay and it'd be in bookstores. Like, you didn't have to hunt it down. You used to have to, like, hunt down scripts at little weird bookstores in Hollywood. And all of a sudden, like, they started publishing scripts for the public to read because, like, you know, art house cinema kind of had a, revival? Revival. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, and it's, well, and this is funny because, like, again, another reason I wasn't sitting around making films is because I live in Nashville. Now, you saying, oh, you had to go to some weird little bookstore in Hollywood. It's like, well, you couldn't go to any bookstore in Nashville and find screenplays.
No, because they were only at these little bookstores in Hollywood because, you know, the actor who is 27th in the call list took his script and sold it to Samuel French because he needed, you know, he needed to buy a sandwich.
And sandwiches are just, they're through the roof out there in L.A.
Oh, my God. Well, $5, man. $5 goes a long way when you're trying to be a working actor.
Right. But,
all right. So it was 5 or so years ago. So was there stuff you did before Rallentondo?
Yeah, I did a series of music videos for myself, for my music. And that really sparked the... reignited the fire.
Right. So you would just pick a song or you would one of your songs, you would hear you would visualize a video for it and you'd be like, okay, I'm going to, so you kind of ran through, I'm sure you called it this before, you did your own work study film school yourself that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Independent study.
You can see the very first fruits of it. If you'd like, they're available on YouTube. I think they're on the Johnny Gowow YouTube channel where you'll find my first, second, third, fourth music video. They increase in quality dramatically with each one because, you know, the first one we shot at a bar. And my first indication that it was a day when the bar was closed. And my first indication that this was going to be a process was, you know, I'd already, you know, organized all the extras to be there. It was a big crowd. I'd gotten the band set up. We had all the playback and everything. So we would have, you know, we'd be able to play the song. And then the cinematographer said, yeah, we're going to want to put garbage bags over all the windows in the front because we don't want daylight in here. And I was like, oh, lights. Yeah. Lighting. Yeah. Oh. So that was like the first time that really, obviously, you know, there's lights in cinema, but you don't realize to what extent there's lights in cinema.
Especially to get a room or a bar to look like an unlit room or bar.
Right.
Takes a lot of lights
right.
to make it look like it's not lit. Yeah. And actually I once dove into, your YouTube. And there's actually, I guess it's not the one you're talking about, but did you direct, there was like a live concert you did. I think it's broken up by song, but it's so professional. It's like lit beautifully. The band is fantastic and together. And it looks like a really high-end concert film, really.
Yeah, that was my first big, what you call live production, I guess.
Were you directing that?
Yeah.
That's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work. And funny story about, I hired two cameramen. So we had two stationary cameras, one guy with a Ronin and one guy with he was operating a tripod. Had, you know, an 8-piece, 9-piece band. And rented out a theater, sold tickets, had about probably 80, 90 people there, filled up the theater. And about 45 minutes before the show, my guitarist still wasn't there. And so I called him and I was like, hey, man, where are you at? And he goes, what? I'm in Georgia. And I was like, what? And he said, is the show tonight? And I said, yes. And he said, dude, I had you down for tomorrow. I'm so fucking sorry. And I said, you can apologize to me later. I have to go. And I ran to my second guitar. Yeah. He was my rhythm guitarist. So I ran to my lead guitarist and I said, hey, do you know anyone? Can you call anyone? And he said, yes. And we called a guy and he showed up and stumbled his way through the songs.
Right. He knew a guy who could read sheet music and you had what he needed.
Correct.
Huge. Huge. Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, I kind of jumped to that one, but so there was a series of videos. That one was later in your, as you were building up your skill set.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
it was my first live.
Yeah. It definitely had that live feel, even though obviously you had seeded the crowd with a friendly crowd that you could boss around and tell them to sit quietly while if you guys needed to take a moment to reset things.
Oh no, it was straight up a live show.
Straight up a live show. You played it the whole way through.
Yeah, yeah. There was no consideration for the film aspect of it. But when we struck the first chord, it was just a show from then on out.
Cool. All right. So you were doing the live concert thing, which is a big deal actually. That's a whole different type of directing. Although we had a film in the June Film Invasion LA that the director of that hilarious film, I don't know if you got to see it.
I did not.
You did not. He he directs all the Weezer concerts for
film. Oh yeah, awesome. Okay.
Yeah. So and then he just took a little money and made a completely bizarre, nonsense, abstract, crazy comedy about people in ICP makeup trying to buy a Hyundai.
Okay. Yeah, I'll check that. Is that the last one?
That was the last one. I'll have to send you a link. Okay. Yeah, I guess you were probably too busy to be on the jury there, on the filmmakers board.
Yes, yeah.
You're a busy man.
I'm down to do that in the future. It's been a weird few months.
No, it's been a weird longer than a few. But anyhow.
Right.
So did you do, and of course, Rallentando is pretty much a short comedic film. It has a brief musical piece in it that could almost function as a music video for that song. But I assume,
yeah.
Were you working your way up? Like, were you doing some pure? Because of course, the year after that, I think you brought Near Dark Radio. We had Near Dark Radio,
right?
Right. But I think that was during COVID, so there was no in person, anything going on.
Yeah, yeah. That was Rallentando was my first. Just pure short film, fictional comedy.
Yeah, and the purpose, I remember now from the Q&A, your purpose wasn't to feature that song. In fact, you were going to use a different song, and then at the last second, you threw in one of your own just because you realized it would work.
Yeah, and I realized that I couldn't use an Elvis song without paying for it.
Paying for it dearly, yeah, without getting your video yanked off of YouTube all the time.
Right. So I was like, wait, I have a song that would fit for this and also complement the jokes in the script. So let's just do that.
So in theory, Rallentando was really fulfilling a long-term dream of yours to make a film, because you had been you've been complementing your music career, directing music video and live concert. And then finally you just did a completely narrative film.
Correct. Yeah. And it was very nice to do that, specifically sketch comedy, because I've always, in the interim between falling in love with Kubrick and Lynch and actually getting my own camera gear, I fell in love with sketch comedy, like Fry and Laurie, what are the other two British fellas?
Old ones, Dudley Moore and Peter Cook?
Monty Python, Fry and Laurie,
right.
Key and Peele, The Chappelle Show, Mitchell and Webb, Kids in the Hall, somewhat. That they actually did not catch me. Their Canadian sensibilities were a little off,
a little too clean.
Me. Yeah, I mean, I thought they were a little too clean. I don't know.
There is a I think you could call them Protestant sons of drunks.
I think sure.
I think most of them. I'm a big fan, but there is a there's an emotional barricade that they all. I am into them, and I watched some. Every one of them has a story of like the drunk out of control dad up in Canada, where it's so cold that you just drink every night and yell at your kids, and so you know.
Right. Right. And then there was one. There's one out of Australia that really got me. That it's I forget the guy's name, but it was the so and so program. Except he always misspelled program, and like several times, like in several seasons, he spelled it pogrom. But if you know what I'm talking about, that it was a very like surrealist, absurdist sketch comedy series that I thought was really good. And then of course the new I Think You Should Leave.
Yeah, really you got, should leave.
Really got me.
Any era of SNL resonate for you on the sketch or
no.
SNL's always been crap.
SNL's always been crap. I mean, I remember liking the Spartan cheerleaders. I remember laughing when Janet Reno busted through the wall of the West Wing. The guy that was there was that guy on Mad TV that was like,
look what I can do. Look what I can do.
I forget what his deal was. But no, those two shows never really.
Yeah, the network sensibility got in the way, honestly.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
You also fell in love with comedy, and you probably were always a funny kid. You probably always had a sense of humor.
Yeah, I always liked to laugh, make jokes, cut up.
Yeah, and in fact, a lot of your music has comic elements, comedic elements.
Yeah.
Which I am only saying based upon the one song that you pulled from Ralentando. But you said something at the Q&A in 2019, the reference of like, yeah, I've got all these gay country and Western tunes, so I might as well pull one in.
Yeah. Yeah, there's several of those. I'm actually remastering my first album right now because I pulled it offline several years ago because I wasn't happy with the mix and my vocal performance, et cetera. So I'm going to maybe do some videos for those old songs. Who knows?
Fun. All right. So how was the Ralentando experience? How was the experience? Was it a ball or was it just good times?
I have never had a bad experience on a set that I am directing.
Wonderful. Of course, done it the smart way, right? You've also always been essentially executive producer. Like you've always had final say.
Right, right. Yeah, and I try to do low budget. I do low budget so that I can have. Now, when you do low budget, you do have to make concessions to the actors and crew if that crops up. So I tend to make my scripts as low maintenance as possible. There's no crazy special effects usually. There's no it's pretty straightforward. Nobody's getting run over by a car.
You write to your budget.
Yeah. I was about to say nobody gets raped, but in the last short that I finished, there is a rape at the end, but it's off camera. So you don't.
Fair enough. And actually, rape is actually a fairly inexpensive.
It's an inexpensive gag.
Yeah, it's not a car chase. It's not, you don't have to have a dolly track.
Right, right, right.
Most definitely. Hey, go ahead and have a sip. So what I forgot to ask is, so did you come up with the script for Ralentando and say, okay, I'm going to make this. It's going to be my first film. Or did you say, I want to make a film finally. And then you kicked ideas around till you came across this one.
No, it was me and my friends outside of a gig, a regular gig that we had at a burlesque show downtown. And it was me and my bandmates. And we just sit outside and cut up after the show. And we came up with this idea of a band leader who's, you know, putting on a, he's got a gig at some dumb Broadway, Nashville Broadway honky tonk, and he's rehearsing his band, but he's taking it very seriously, and he's using all these orchestral terms, like old classical terms, to his band, and his band is getting confused, especially one member of the band. And I was like, man, like, this is funny. This would be very funny. I need to sit down and write the script. Like, why not? My band is all on board if we want to shoot it.
Yeah, it was already cast at the idea stage.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So and I said, and were you planning on your little cameo from the beginning, or did that evolve?
No, that was when I worked in the gay country song at the end. I realized, oh, we can have this whole faggot situation and cut to the fagot, the bassoon.
Yeah, the bassoon pun.
Yeah, yeah. Which I don't know if anyone got, but.
It was an educational experience for me. I did not know that that was the, it's the German term for bassoon, fagot?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And it's the standard orchestral term.
Standard, right. So at the orchestral level, they use that term all the time.
Yeah, if you're in a symphony in Europe, you're very likely to see faggot written on the score. And I've always thought that's funny. If you play organ, there's a very common stop on a pipe organ is the faggot. So I also play organ, so every once in a while I'll take a picture of the faggot stop and post it on Instagram. And
because it's fun, because you're having fun with it. Because
it's funny.
It is very funny. So you have this, so how long was it a quick prep? Because you knew, hey, I just need to get a room, throw my band in it.
Yeah.
Have them say the words.
Yeah. It was, I mean, I rehearsed it with them a couple of times because they weren't actors. So I wanted to make sure everybody was, you know, getting the right feel for everything, being experimental, playing with it. But yeah, it was 2 days shoot, quick and easy. The crew was me. I was behind the camera. My friend Lauren was running sound, and my friend Kelly was sort of script supervisor, PA, grabbing us lunch. So 3-person crew, 5-person cast, easy peasy.
And did you choose your drummer to be the main foil of the lead singer because he could pull off a pissed off country dude best?
Yeah, well, he's from South Georgia. He's a Jew from South Georgia, so he normally does not sound like he sounded in the film, but he was able to tap that accent very easily and pull up the.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I remember seeing your concert video after it and going, "Wow, look at them all cleaned up." But I had no idea. Right. I had no idea he was a member of the tribe. What do you know? Now,
yeah.
Yeah,
no, and he took that role very seriously, and I really appreciate it. And he, it was okay. So I was about to say when you asked how Rallentondo went from start to the finish, the last premiere I had, which was at Sherman Oaks. Great, great experience. The one hiccup. Was it premiered at the Nashville Film Festival first, and he was there. The drummer came, the bass player came. Actually, the bass player came, and we sat down in the theater to watch it, and it was in a series of comedy shorts. And the first short started, and we were like, huh. The sound is off. The audio is off. It's delayed. Like, it started out, like, barely perceptible, and then by the end of the first short, it was quite
getting,
pronounced.
Every moment it was getting off, the sync was off, getting worse somehow.
Right, right, somehow. And then mine was the second one. And it's got a bunch of music in it. It's got a bunch of, like, you know, a drummer slamming down his sticks, like really sharp cues. And it was all just fucked. And so, you know, a lot of my friends and family had come, blah, blah, blah. Like, we stood up after everybody in the theater that was a filmmaker that was in the theater stood up after mine and said, hey, this is not working. The sound is completely off.
Right. So if only you'd been third, it could have been saved. But
well, no, they just stopped it and they had to cancel that screening.
Oh, so they couldn't even fix it. I wonder what the fuck the problem was.
It was a corrupted file of some sort. It was they said what it was. I didn't care. I was just mad.
Yeah.
So there was a second screening of it, and then they rescheduled a third screening of it to replace that, and they were perfectly fine the second and third times. But
cool. And your family was able to come back from that. Friends and family were able to come out again.
Well, they didn't. My parents did. A couple of my family members were going to go to the second screening anyway.
Oh, but actually, I had one more question. Back to the person playing lead singer,
uh-huh,
in Ralentando. Was that just someone in your band who normally didn't sing and they lip synced to you? Or did you have them sing?
He does sing.
He did sing.
He's a singer. He sings in my band. He sings in his own band. Alex Kramer, if you want to look him up. But he, I got him to do it because he's got a great personality, very fun, very playful. And I was going to have him sing it, but I realized like our voices are similar enough that I don't need to bring him into the studio and track him singing the song when I've already got mine, and we'll just have him pretend it's his voice.
Right, and he did a great job.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, cool. So you have that National Theater, of course. I guess we can call Sherman Oaks your West Coast or L.A. premiere.
Mm-hmm.
And
thanks for making it happen.
Hey, thanks for submitting it.
Yeah.
As I recall, it was Shapiro was in the Sherman Oaks area, and you figured, hey, maybe I'll.
Oh yeah, that's when I was like trying to like
Ben Shapiro. You're like, Ben Shapiro lives in Sherman Oaks. I'll submit to the film festival in his neighborhood.
Right, right. God, that's so odd.
Worked out for me. And what are the odds I remember you telling me that?
Well, yeah. Well, now he's based in Nashville, and I don't want to work for him at all. So.
Understood. All right. So you had a great festival run, and then you got back to music and did the superb, really artful music video for Near Dark Radio, which you then named your podcast after. I assume that was the order.
Right. Yes. Podcast was named Near Dark Radio after the song.
But did Ralentando did that just completely inspire you that you want to do a lot more narrative? The fire?
Yeah.
But you can't
and
turn
it really sorry.
No, I was just gonna say you can't turn your back on your primary source of income. I'm not in just a source
right,
of income,
right,
but,
right.
Your primary work as an artist is as a musician. So it's not like it would be smart to go, you know, I'm going to quit music and devote myself to cinema.
Right.
I mean,
when I'd had one short film that made it into two film festivals, like, yeah, no,
yeah,
gotta keep trucking with the music.
Yeah. Which you enjoy and are amazing.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
But Ralentando really, I guess more than anything, that and the second short film I made, which I still haven't released yet, because I'm saving it for a future project that is in the works right now, was the ease with which you could write a script if you just started it. Like, my biggest thing with getting into filmmaking was, what do you call it, imposter syndrome, I guess?
Which everybody has, but sure, absolutely.
Right, like, everybody has with every aspect of their life.
The kids who went to film school and studied film for 4 years, you know, 3 solid years, come out, make a short, and they're like, they go to festival, and they're like, well, I don't belong here.
Right. And I didn't feel that way, but it was like once I did it and went to the festivals and saw people enjoy what I'd done, I was like, wow, I literally just sat down at a fucking keyboard and typed that out, and it came to me as I wrote it, a lot of it, and it was the lines that are funny I made up on the spot. And I guess what I was... My problem with screenwriting was always, I always tried to plan it out. You know, they tell you to, you know, develop your narrative arc, you know, do all your character studies, make all of your, get all of your flashcards and write out all your scenes and arrange them in different colors so that you know where the scenes are. And then, you know, make sure that 10 minutes in you have a you know, inciting event and you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And like, to a certain extent, all that's true, but the formulaic quality of it, like the whole, like, you really have to plan this out. If you sit down at a laptop and start trying to write a screenplay, you'll fail. That's not true. That's not true at all. Yes, you want to know who your characters are. You want to have some background to them. Yes, you want to know what happens. You want to know what the end is going to be. You want to know if somebody gets killed, or while you're sitting there writing the script, sometimes things change drastically and you come up with something really good in the moment and you keep writing. And that was the experience I had with that first screenplay, the second screenplay, and then I'm writing a web series now, like a sketch comedy series, and it's like literally just, oh, you have a funny idea? Sit down and write it.
Yeah, well, sketch particularly lends itself towards, I like how you said improvisation, even at the keyboard. When you're at the computer keyboard, you can still be improvising. You can be... You know, you can go into it thinking you're going to write this, and then just something comes to you, and yeah, turn it on a dime, have fun with it.
Mm-hmm. Whatever flows.
Yeah.
You have to make sure it's flowing.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Cool. So you've been writing a lot of sketch, and you said you there's a feature too?
Yes, I'm actually working on a feature right now. I'm about 50 pages into that. That is not a comedy, although in the rewrite, there's going to be some darker comedy. You can't have just a dramatic piece. At least I can't. I can't write just a dramatic piece that's just like, you know, I'm not going to be the writer on Big Little Lies. That's not me.
Well, and it makes sense for you essentially to get a first draft out where you focus on the narrative and the characters and the drama of the story. And then when you writing is rewriting, you're going to be punching it up and having fun with it and throwing in, because you don't, the comedy, it's kind of a weird thing to say, but the comedy comes naturally for you. So you got to focus on, you got to build the house,
right?
Then you got to decorate it.
Right, right, right. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. And I'm actually going to keep that in my head when I'm doing rewrites. Decorating.
You are going to decorate the fuck out of that with comedy.
Throw pillows.
And honestly, comedy isn't comedy within the framework of a drama often what makes you laugh harder than something that's just trying from the get-go to like sing and dance for you, make you laugh?
I think so. I mean, I really loved that show, recent show, The White Lotus.
I finished that last night.
Oh, good. I was very disappointed at the ending. But
agreed.
The the rest of the show was this really great mixture of really tense drama and like personal situations with just this biting comedy, just like this scathing, like funny things.
Well, yeah.
Funny writing.
We can spoil it. I mean, the hotel manager is a hilarious,
yes,
perfectly acted character.
Yes, and I have a major crush on that actor now.
How could you not? And the shit he took was beautiful.
Yeah.
Just beautiful. I did get a kick out of the fact that show... Yeah, go ahead.
I loved the fact that that was the first time I saw a semi-hard dick and balls, a rim job, and a person taking a shit outside of a porno. I've never seen a person taking a shit in a porno. That's not my...
I've seen an accidental one in a porno, but it wasn't the purpose of it. One of those Coke bottle moments, you know?
Right. But yeah, no, it was...
I'm with you. I actually said to my partner while we were watching, I said... Because they show the girl's tits, I think, in the first episode, too. But they show the dick and balls first.
Right,
and I was like,
right.
Thank God we got some balance here, you know?
Yeah. It was nice.
It was. Although, God, what a show. The fact that I guess they decided they wanted to show us that everything works out for the rich people.
Yeah, and I didn't think so much. I mean, I read a couple of reviews. One of them was like, oh, look, of course it works out for the rich people. That's the point. They're trying to show that it's futile to war against the system or whatever. And it's like, no, I think that was just the writer, whatever his name is, David White.
Mike White.
Like, he just sort of... He didn't have a great idea for the ending. He had a lot of really great plot development, character development, although not so much. It was just more exploring these characters. But like it, I just think he didn't have a good ending for it, and that's what he shot, and that's what we got.
So it had a lot of great elements, and it was good.
Yeah. But it, so like. A show like that's more in my wheelhouse if I'm going to be doing drama or, you know, there's got to be a playfulness to it. There's got to be,
for sure. You know,
it can't be Titanic.
No, can't take itself. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So that's what you're working on. And, I'm glad you mentioned, I was going to pretend to be all butthurt about if you made another short and then it hasn't come out to, hasn't been submitted to a festival yet, because you know I'll set you up. But so you're keeping this short to make it part of a feature or make it part of something else, or
no? I plan on using Rallentondo and this short as part of the pilot for this
web series.
If I need to, like if I can't get enough shot to make a pilot, I can stick these in there.
Right, because it's a sketch comedy pilot, so you could always jump to the Rallentondo sketch, jump to the other sketch. Got it. Yeah, Rallentondo is absolutely sketch comedy. Absolutely.
But, you know, if the thing works out, like it's, you know, I Think You Should Leave, which is a sketch comedy show on Netflix, those episodes are only 15 to 20 minutes long. I don't think any of them actually reaches 20 minutes. So I've got to get 15 to 20 minutes down like that. If I'm going to try to pitch a pilot, it's not that hard. It's just making sure I get the right actors, making sure I get the scripts real nice and tight and punchy. And
yeah, I think the new credo, people can try to blame attention span if they want, but the new credo is shorter is better. Like, you don't have to have, you know, it went from 10 half-hour episodes was required for a first season. It went down to 8, now 6. And they don't all have to be an hour or a half hour. If they're shorter, you know, audiences, you know, it's more important not to bore your audience with filler, you know?
It really is. It really is. And I think of it this way. Like, if you watch a show like Big Little Lies, which is only two seasons, if you watch a show, and they're like 6-7 episodes per season, if you watch a show like The White Lotus, if you watch, what you're watching is like novel-length material. You're watching like a standard 200-300-page novel. It's not, you know, your 1,500-page Tolstoy, but it's not, you know, what I consider a feature film is more. You're better to try to if you're going to base a feature film off of a book, you're better off looking for a novella or a short story.
Always.
Because it's only an hour and a half. All you've got is an hour and a half, 2 hours. So, yeah, I just think of it. I think of it that way, and I don't think it's an attention span issue so much as it is just like with the internet, we have the freedom to play with different lengths.
So, absolutely. Streaming and the internet freed us from the 22 minutes per half hour with commercials framework that choked to death. And by the way, and 22 episodes per season, like right. BBC, all those BBC comedies always seem funnier than ours, but it's because they do 6 to 9 a year, not 22. Yep. Like who can be funny for a half hour, 22 times a year? Like Fawlty right. Towers would have sucked if he had to do 120 episodes in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Absolutely. And you, I mean, the only one I can think of is like Seinfeld.
Yeah, they never lost it.
it never quite lost it, but it's a show about nothing. So it was literally the perfect example of a sitcom. It's situational comedy. You get a few writers in a room, come up with situations, done. We're good.
Absolutely,
it writes itself.
Yeah, the characters got so funny. The characters mm-hmm. were so well-defined that it was pretty hard to write a bad script for those four.
Right.
You had your ABCD story. You know, each one of them had their little plot line. So you didn't have to come up with great ideas because you just, all right, Kramer's going to want cotton candy. He's about to be funny.
Right.
You know? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, back in 1991 or two, I wrote a Seinfeld spec.
Really?
Yeah, right out of college. I was...
Nice.
I had dreams, like everybody else.
Yeah, we all do, don't we?
I don't know. When we're young.
I mean, I still do. I'm just, I guess... I mean, we can kind of get into this if you want to. The traditional industry is in such a state that I don't think any reasonable creative person would be interested in trying to pursue a career within that industry. They're most likely, unless you're an actor. If you're an actor, you're kind of at the whim of whoever will
cast you. Still, you went from network test to streaming test, but you still are...
You're just a vessel, I guess. But
yeah,
if you're a writer, if you're a director, if you're even if you're a cinematographer, you know, more of a technical type. Like, there's so many other independent outlets and independent opportunities that trying to get in through the big brass doors at, you know, Paramount Studios just seems absurd at this point.
For sure, yeah. Unless
your dad works there.
Yeah, or your uncle or someone. But who wants to, you know, if I told you my neighbor sold a show to Paramount Plus, you'd be like, eh. If I told you my neighbor sold a show to Netflix, you'd be like, wow, it must be good.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Paramount, yeah, it's a complete, I guess... But it's just the giants shifted. That's all. It shifted from 3 or 4 studios to 3 or 4 streaming platforms.
Yeah. And just the, you know, the production companies. There's so many more production companies now. And that, I guess that means there's also a lot more shitty production companies that'll try to do anything. But it also means there's a lot more outlets for creative, you know, good creatives to get their stuff produced.
Hopefully, yeah. And hopefully this over, you know, we don't know. Lord knows everything's been turning upside down lately. At some point, I sure would hope that that creators like yourself find more receptive platforms.
Yeah. I mean, barring the economic collapse that is, I'm almost 100% sure we're about to experience, yeah, I think there's a lot more, you know, even if you would look at, like, I mean, because, for example, a lot of my comedy, I'm not very political with my comedy, but there are elements in my comedy that are not acceptable in polite society. For example, there's a rape at the end of that short that I consider a comedy. It's, you know, it's not, rape is not funny to me, but this sketch is it's a comedy sketch. And well, that would not, I don't see that flying very well. I haven't released it yet, so I don't know, but I don't see that flying very well in the Hollywood circuit. I don't see that flying
for
very
sure,
well.
Depending on how it goes. Well, I mean, I do recall we had a interesting experience at Sherman Oaks. You remember the woman, she raised her hand and she couldn't ask the question. She wanted to ask the question,
yeah.
But you know, the forgot joke and
yeah.
The song, she wasn't sure about having permission to laugh and.
Right. Yeah, she needed it. And she's like, because in the sketch, I say faggot. It's pronounced faggot, referring to myself.
Yeah, you correct the other ones. You're like, no, faggot.
Yeah, yeah. And she asked after, I went back and watched our interview, which I'm planning on putting on my YouTube channel here in the next few days. The Q&A at the end, she's like, is it, are you, I, it's, I, just, I could, and I was like, are you asking if I'm gay? And she said, yes, yes, I am. And I said, yes, I am gay. And she goes, oh, okay. All right. I know. I get it now. It's funny. And I
was she's like, okay, I can, yeah, because she was a little on guard for that, which was,
yeah. And I should have, but I had taken an edible before the show. So I was kind of just like chill.
I find this out 2 years later that you took an edible. Right.
I also spilled wine all over my jacket.
Wait till I tell you the next festival type venture I have. I'm creating a monthly movie night called THC Cinema.
Ooh,
films.
Which involves the consumption of THC.
You are good because of the laws of California. It's legal to consume THC, whether it's an edible or smoked or, you know, a suppository. The whole point is you have to do it on private property. So arrive at the theater prepared to see comedy and art and animation that just is even better when you're high.
I like that. I like that. So you consume your consumables and then come to the show.
Yeah. I'm actually thinking of approaching Uber or Lyft about, like, yeah, how about a discount rate?
Dude.
How about a discount
rate
for people who want to come to THC Cinema?
Absolutely.
Because I have a feeling the theater owner would kick us out if everyone lit up like they do at a Pink Floyd Laserium thing. Like, because then
theater's
going to stink for days.
Yeah, and it's just, it's liability. It's, yeah, you don't want that. But yeah, no, I mean, Uber Eats just did those horrible commercials with Elton John and Lil Nas X where they're like practically sucking each other's dick without doing it. I'm sure they'd be fine with some weed promo.
For sure. They should be promoting the fact that, hey, pot's legal in California for anyone over 21.
Right.
But you shouldn't drive high, everyone. We're here for you. Yeah. But anyway, sounds like you would... enjoy that festival, that you would enjoy that movie. And I decided I cannot handle the work of another, you know, 4 to 6 day festival. But one day a month through the year, I think that's doable, especially if I get to be high for the night.
Yeah. Yeah. Put it up. I'll write a screenplay for it. See if we can.
Maybe you should. Maybe you should try to squeeze in something
between the cheeks.
Between, you know, it's actually, THC Cinema is on Film Freeway now. What can I say? It says brought to you by people who do the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. Although I think I'm going to keep the nonprofit that runs the two festivals away from THC Cinema. I'm not sure.
Probably smart.
The odds of the IRS coming down that, hey, that's not part of your mission objectives or whatever as a nonprofit. Right. But, you know, it's honestly, I just keep seeing great films and I'm like, that was so funny. And I probably would have laughed till I cried if I was high.
See, I don't like to view cinema when I'm high. Unless it's something that I love and adore. Like I'm going back and watching American Beauty or something because it helps me see things that I didn't see before. But when I'm first watching a movie or a TV show, I tend to like to do it sober because I get very analytical when I smoke. And that, I mean, when I used to smoke 7 years and a day ago. It distances me from the suspension of disbelief. Like, but yeah.
So you quit smoking, but you still enjoy an edible now and then, or just wait, 'cause you were in California and it was being sold everywhere.
Well, no, I live in Tennessee.
Yeah. Where it's not legal.
Right. So what I was saying was that I used to smoke weed a long time. Seven years and a day ago was the last time I did.
Oh, that was for legal purposes.
Right.
Understood. I missed that. I missed that one. Sorry.
But so people are, it's open for submissions?
It is, actually. We're open for submissions. I'm actually making a point. Don't submit yet because I'm making a, you're going to write something for it. But I actually want to reach out to some of the really great trippy films that have been at the festival over the last 6 years and say, look, you know, you can have like this massive, you've already been supportive. Just here's a waiver, you know?
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay.
I'm afraid to announce it right now on social media and have people like, you know, pay another $40. I'm like, I feel bad. You paid $40 to submit a film that I had my eyes on anyway.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, give him a break. Give him a break.
Seems like you should. Well, so that's a distraction, or that was a tangent. So, what else you got going on? You have this filmmaking bug. You're working on the sketch comedy thing.
Yeah.
Have you been tempted to embarrass yourself on stage doing sketch, or you've avoided that?
I did do a couple of stand-up nights. 2019, I guess. I like the audio format. I like the podcast. I like the podcast because you can do, you know, you don't have to, I'm not a theatrical person. I'm using my hands right now, but that's to demonstrate how non-theatrical I am.
Which is funny because I've seen your stage concert, but I guess music is completely different.
Well, no, I mean, if you watch my stage concert, like it's the one you mentioned, that one I'm very tense, very like not using my hands. After 3 years, 3.5 years of band leading for a burlesque show, I got a lot better at being more performative, but I don't know. I guess a part of me was just kind of, when I got up there to do stand up, I was like, man, these people know what they're doing. I don't know what I'm doing. I was funnier than some of the dumbasses that came in on those nights, but the actual comics, you could tell they're like, they know what they're doing.
Absolutely.
So I don't know. I'll probably do it again, but no, I like the sketch. I'm not very good at improvisation in music or, most aspects of my life, let's be honest.
Yeah, well, you're a very cerebral person, actually. I know that from listening to your podcast. The one I listened to with the music professor, your compositions are incredibly well thought out. You're not, it's not like the Rolling Stones where it's just like, this chord, let's just, twist the blues around one more time. And do absolutely nothing original.
Dude, if you want to see some of the worst, most dispiriting evidence that the boomer generation was a bunch of fuck-ups, watch the Rock and Roll Circus that they recorded in, I think, 68, maybe 67. And they only released it in the 90s. But it's very up close, it's a concert video, very well produced, in which the Rolling Stones just sort of jitter around on stage for 2.5 hours. It's so weird. It's so weird to see, what's his name? Mick Jagger doing his thing, like that he was doing back at the day, where it literally looks like he's having a seizure. I don't know if the novelty of it was so appealing at the time or what, but it does not stand up to the test of time. Anyone that's been to a Rolling Stones concert recently knows that.
They should.
Yeah. It's odd.
I've had a hobby of pissing off Stones fans for about 30 years. In college, a roommate, a guy moved into our house, and he looked at my CDs or something. He says, "Do you like the Stones?" And I went, "Not really." I forget what. The Black Crowes were big when I was in college.
Uh-huh.
Who were I think they were Stones sound alike. And right. He goes, said something about Black Crowes. I was like, "I don't like that band." He goes, "Really? But they're so much like the Stones." I go, "Yeah, I mean, anyone can be dull and repetitive."
There's two Rolling Stones songs I do really like, Ruby Tuesday and Under My Thumb.
Andrew, I really like...
That's about it.
I think I like Gimme Shelter. I think that's actually the one with the refrain, rape, murder. Well, there's a little...
Rape, murder, yeah, I love that.
But the music itself, there's more ideas, there's more musical ideas in one Beatles song than, five Stones records.
Absolutely.
Because the Stones, they're just playing the same blues scale, and they're
Yeah, it's heroin music. It's heroin music.
Fair enough.
The Beatles were... probably some, legal uppers at the beginning of things, and then psychedelics.
Yeah. Whereas
it's different kinds of musics.
Yes. And
I had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine about, he's got a theory that, the eras of pop music follow the drugs that are popular in the culture at the time. So you have the psychedelics of the late 60s and early 70s. You have the heroin.
Cocaine comes in for disco.
Cocaine comes in, fucking rides it through the 80s. You have heroin hitting people. You get grunge. You get the Seattle shit in the early 90s. And then I think what we have now is people on psychological medications, like SSRIs and benzos and... doing some Adderall, and it's all very, I don't know. You get things like Billie Eilish and,
Yeah, at this point it's so fragmented, an old person in their 50s isn't supposed to really know what's going on the music scene.
I mean...
But, even hip-hop, hip-hop was obviously a rebirth of weed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think in the country music scene, at least in the what they call outlaw country music. It's sort of, I won't say independent because there's a couple of major labels involved, but they are people like Sturgill Simpson, Jason Isbell, those types. I think you do get a nice little bit of weed and a couple of beers vibe from it. It's like chill, and you can kind of think weird, but it's not like you know, Strawberry Alarm Clock, incense and peppermints. Like let's all go to the moon.
That could be a sketch. Start with the Strawberry Alarm Clock, and then pan over to the peppermints.
We've gotten off on music. That is, I feel like I've hijacked your podcast.
No, and I almost encouraged it. Because you are a musician and a composer and all these things, but have we talked to John Gower, the filmmaker? Does the filmmaker John Gower have more to share? I mean, I know the last 18 months, there were a lot of limits. I know it was hard for you not to be able to perform music live, but it also was probably challenging to do film production.
Much less challenging to do film production. I actually did more film production. I worked on a lot more sets in the past year and a half than I played shows.
Yeah, weird, because I used to be many nights a week.
Yeah, and it's weird. I find this part of like the whole hypocrisy of the COVID era, the COVID policies, is like there were lots of industries that just continued to function after the initial, you know, 2 months, 3 months. They opened back up for business. Like Hollywood, for example, you just had to have enough money to be able to test everybody every day and tell your unionized workers to wear masks. You had to have that kind of clout and you could go on with business as usual. Whereas, same in the music industry, you could put on big, car park shows, not car park, drive-in movie theater shows, which, can you imagine singing your songs to a bunch of people who are like flashing their headlights and honking their horns at you and you can't see any of them, and half of them are probably like giving each other hand jobs? Like,
no, I cannot. I didn't know of the music shows that did that. I know that there were some stand-up for cars, just
right.
Crazy. I can't imagine that would not be maddening for the performer, but I guess people got to make money somehow.
Right.
Funny thing about COVID is a lot of the out-of-work actors I knew were able to get jobs as COVID compliance officers, because you needed, you know, every production now had to hire
right
10 to 20 people to administer all these tests and track everyone and be mask Nazis and everything. Yeah, it was
it's become a total economy. It's become a part of the economy. And that's what's going to be hardest about getting out of this, is that you have a lot of jobs now. You have a lot of egos. You have a lot of careerists that are now fully converted to, hey, I'm here to make sure you're not sick before you come into this room. And it's like, is this what? Is this going to be the fucking the thing? Is this going to be the new thing? I hope not.
We got no idea what the thing is going to be, but we'll see. It's going to unfold before our eyes. I mean, I still didn't understand most. I mean, you know, I've walked around a studio lot. I mean, I didn't understand why they couldn't just create bubbles, just throw everyone in the bubble. You don't have to test every week. Just put them in dorms.
Well, and they did. They did. I mean, you know, Tom Cruise shot them. Like, lots of people shot movies. I think what the big wall that they came up, that a lot of them came up against, was we are part of the mechanism that is transmitting the narrative to the vast majority of Americans. If we start putting out movies where people know, like it's filmed, that these people are all unmasked, they're all, you know, getting real close to each other, they're working in tight quarters, we don't have the moral high ground anymore. And so they had to kind of do the whole imagine all the people thing.
Well, and they also just had to delay the shit because even if they could shoot it in their bubbles, people aren't going back to the theater, and you can't.
Right, they're not going back to the theaters.
You can't get a Tom Cruise movie out of the red if it makes $20 million in a month at the theaters, because most people are just like, yeah, it's not really worth it. You know, it's not going to be, you know.
And I'm surprised. Like, I think this, again, we don't know what this is going to look like, but I had the impression at the beginning of COVID that it was obviously going to be hard for the small guys, but always thought of it as an opportunity for the small guys, because the big guys are still working on a certain business model, the 20th century Hollywood business model, which is extremely expensive. It's extremely time consuming. You have to, it takes a lot of money to get out of the red. Whereas if you're an independent and you're used to doing stuff on a low budget, you might just click into this new economic, you know, create a new economic model.
For sure. And
that works for streaming, because streaming doesn't make any fucking money except for the streaming platforms.
Yeah. And actually, I know a guy who made, it's all who you know, but his parents own a bed and breakfast in Pennsylvania. So he grabbed a certain number of people from LA, and I think they flew across to there. You know, they were responsible. They waited their 2 weeks and whatever. They waited it out for a week or two.
See, who cares?
I don't even know if they did that, to be honest. But they just, right. they created their own little bubble. They created their own little bubble at a bed and breakfast with, you know, 10 rooms, and they shot a little horror movie, and now it is completed. And, you know, I think Gravitas picked it up and, you know, for streaming, and, you know, they didn't get theatrical. And yeah, I mean, I bet his timing was perfect, because 2 years ago, you know, there were so many films clogging the airwaves. Yeah, maybe maybe he's got a chance someone will notice it. We'll see.
I hope so.
But yeah, every bed and breakfast in the country should have had a little film crew in it, and people shooting stuff on DSLRs. I mean,
right.
This was the perfect time to do your own version of Fawlty Towers.
right. Well, and they did. I mean, that's how they did White Lotus. They shot that during the pandemic, and they were like, okay, well, we're gonna lock down this hotel that's already pretty much shut down and isn't making any money. We're going to buy it out. We're going to quarantine there, and then we're going to shoot this show.
Yeah, the Four Seasons Maui. Yeah, and I was going to tell, I heard an interesting interview with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, his new show on Apple TV Plus.
I've heard speak of this.
Yeah, they were about to shoot it when COVID broke out. And I think A24 was producing it, and they just said, well, infection rates are zero in New Zealand, and they just flew the cast to New Zealand, and they shot it down there, like, with no mask, no problem. Because they're like, everyone, I think they did wait their 2 weeks, but then after 2 weeks, they could just shoot a whole season of a show. And it was like, yeah, we didn't need, like, in New Zealand, the infection rate was zero, and we were like, why would we go back to the USA right now? Well, we can have perfectly normal lives in this island in the southern hemisphere.
Are they still good? They're still just not locked down. They're not doing the Australian thing.
I heard they had one case in like the last month or two, and their prime minister said, we're going to keep our eye on it. Something like that.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when your rate is zero, you can care about the one case. Like, no, that guy's got to stay in the airport hotel. We're going to lock him down for 3 weeks.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Pretty, I mean, obviously, it's a lot easier to manage an island in the South Pacific than it is.
Exactly, yeah.
This big contiguous 50 crazy states, but.
50 states? Yeah.
I said contiguous 50, but we're not. 48 is.
Yeah. Although Hawaii's having a bad time of it, aren't they?
I'm not sure. They'd had really strict rules about taking us mainlanders. But yeah, maybe now that they reopened, they're getting hit. Because once they've got it, it's hard because they all live close together.
Yeah. And there's, all the morbidly obese Pacific Islanders. It's...
It's a look. Yeah, no, but it's...
Well, it's a look until you have a respirator on you.
For sure, for sure. Yeah. Well, we're talking COVID now. Do you... I don't want to waste your time. Should we jump into the... Should I wrap this up and then we'll start up again to get your four questions answers? Because I do I do those as separate podcasts. And I think I know us well enough. We could probably shoot the shit for another hour and really test people's patience.
Well, I got another 20 minutes in me.
Oh, excellent. All right. Well, where do you want people to go to find your stuff? Do you want to give your YouTube or your social media?
I would like people to look up Tone Deaf Productions on YouTube. Tone Deaf is hyphenated if you want to really do the search right. That's where all my, well... The professional video work that I do, I put there. And then, yeah, go listen to the podcast, Near Dark Radio. It's on Spotify and Apple and all the things. Follow Near Dark Radio on Twitter. That's the only Twitter account I have. So I use it mostly for podcasting purposes, but... I'll post music and shit on it if I got stuff to send out. And yeah.
And that's good. That's good. We're good.
Yeah.
All right. I will now name all the shit people should look up here. And by the way, I'm going to grade Grub for stars. Everyone should, by the way, go when you go to look up Tone-Deaf Pro on YouTube, make sure you give like stars and likes and shit on the videos. Why not?
Subscribe, you bastards.
Subscribe. And subscribe to the Near Dark Radio podcast. Subscribe to this podcast you're listening to. And give it 5 stars, whether it's on Apple or, I don't know. It is on all the services, too. I don't know which ones allow 5 stars and which ones have likes. If you're really kind, give a review. You know, this. It doesn't hurt to be kind to people you never met. So just give this 5 stars. Give a subscribe, review, all that. And while we're talking about that, at the very beginning of this, we talked about John Gower's film, Ralentando, which is in the Discovering Indie Film TV series. Go to Amazon.com and look up Discover Indie Film and give each season 5 stars. Oddly enough, you can't give the series 5 stars. It's season by season. Who designed it? I don't know.
Well, they also designed Jeff Bezos's rocket to look like a giant penis. So
it was a beautiful penis.
They're not bringing their best.
I don't know. I could debate whether or not that penis was the best.
It had no curvature to it.
It wasn't an attractive penis. Wasn't as good as whoever was Steve Zahn's stand-in. or semi-in.
I wonder if it was him.
I was told that it wasn't.
Okay.
And you could tell with the way they edited it, they didn't tilt up or anything.
Right.
Pretty isolated body. So shame on him for not doing it. Even if he's ashamed of his belly, like he should have.
Come on. When do you
get the chance? I mean,
he won't ever again.
I'm no Louis C.K., but anyone who wants it, it should be seen. These things should be seen. I'm against it.
They should be seen, and they're not weird.
I'm against the gentle prejudice against the penis, but that's a whole nother podcast for us. So anyway, I derailed myself. Discover Indie Film, Amazon Prime Video. Look up Discover Indie Film on Prime Video anywhere you get it. Go to Season 3, Episode 8. I believe there's 4 hilarious comedies in that episode, including Ralentando, written and directed, and with a cameo from the writer-director John Gower in it. And if you want to learn more about this podcast and that TV series, go to discoverindiefilm.com. And on social media, it's at DIFWins. We mentioned a couple times during our chat that I met John at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. We hold that every November. ShermanOaksFF.com and at ShermanOaksFF on social media. And there is a sister festival, Film Invasion Los Angeles, and that is FilmInvasionLA.com, and it's at FilmInvasionLA on social media. And I have now completed the spiel. 5 stars. I want to see some stars.
I want to see some stars, too.
I have to admit, no insult.
I want to see some stars penises.
Yes. It's about time. Who showed? Well, that was one of the good things about Game of Thrones, right? But
I never watched it.
Oh. It's got a halfway decent dick ratio, but I was going to add that for someone who's had like 95 people on his podcast, it's kind of weird that it only has like 12 five stars.
Ah!
I'm not asking you, but I am implying that you should give it 5 stars. And I will.
He's not asking. He's telling you to give the podcast that you were on a 5-star review.
I am implying that would be a logical thing. And by the way, I certainly gave Near Dark Radio 5 stars.
You're one of like 5 people.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And I've had at least 25 guests I'm on.
That's funny.
So yeah.
You know, I guess it's not a big deal.
Do your due diligence, folks. I understand not sharing it on social media if you said something that you're not comfortable with your, you know, professional colleagues hearing you say, but iTunes reviews are anonymous.
You know, when you brought up that perhaps people were offended thing, I really just wanted to launch into like the good things that Hitler had to say, but that's, and I
we'll
say
do that
is,
on the bonus. We'll do that on the Patreon.
That's the extra. All right. And to the lovely lady in the audience who wanted to make sure that John was allowed to joke around with the word faggot, I'll add that I'm a Jew boy, so I can joke about the Hitler, right? Do we have to qualify our shit?
No. I'm never doing it again.
Never. Never again. All right. Thank you all for listening. All right. Back in the day, I would split it, but I think we can just keep going since we have this like double recording thing going. Should we clap again?
Yeah.
I love seeing your kitty cat walk around behind you now and then.
Oh, my dog.
Don't mention her too much. I don't think she's on the GoPro, which is going to be your final video.
Cool. Well, I'm not. I didn't. This is in between. Do you want to refill water?
Now she's screaming.
You need another?
Nope. I'm good.
All right. We will do a focused podcast on your answers to the 4 questions. So, you know, I am not texting a stranger I'm not texting while you're talking. I'm actually sending your answers to myself in an email as you speak. So that's why I'll be looking down. Well, you know, that way I don't have to like listen back to it and type out your answers. I just have them. A fan somewhere like a year or two, no, 2 years ago, a fan was like, can you have the answers to the 4 questions in the, you know, on the website of the podcast so I can type in a movie and see everyone who mentioned it? And I was like, okay, I'll do that.
That's smart. No, that's smart.
It's kind of fun because then I get to, who knows what your answers are going to be, but it's kind of fun to type it in and see just like all the people who put Dark Knight in their top 3 and then the people who said Dark Knight's the most overrated. Like that's...
No, that's nice.